That's right. This is the Elder Law Coach, and my name is Todd Whatley. I am a certified elder law attorney, and as always, I'm extremely thankful that you downloaded my podcast, and hopefully you have subscribed and you get it every time we do a new one. And I'm super excited today because I have developed a relationship with a new financial planner, and you'll know why I emphasize that in just a second. And he has truly opened my eyes. I've been doing this almost 26 years now, and I thought I understood the financial industry and how it worked. And I met Abe CFP, and he started doing the radio show with me, and I have learned a lot. And he actually encouraged me to get my Series 65 so I can do investments and things. And just that whole process, really how low level it was, surprised me. And I just started learning some really interesting things that I just never knew about, even after doing this for 25 plus years. And I want to do this episode so that you understand some of the insight to how the financial industry works. And I also want to be your resource, and Ian, his office is now in my office. And so if you have questions or concerns or things going on, I'm sure he would be glad to answer those questions. And so let me introduce my guest today, Ian Weiner.
Todd, thanks for having me on the show.
I know, world's longest intro, huh?
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
So, introduce yourself a little bit, talk about your certification, and then let's jump into some of the nitty-gritty of the financial industry.
This is going to be fun. I want to encourage folks, you know, if you're listening to this, you go, look, I already got a financial advisor. Listen anyway, okay? Even if that financial advisor is your brother-in-law, I can almost guarantee you that you'll learn something today. Mm-hmm. And if we do a good job, you should be probably shocked and a little bit mad by the end of it.
Well, and I'm hoping they are listening to this, not just for themselves, but their clients.
Yes.
When a client comes to you and says, my financial advisor said blah or blah, you know, this or that or whatever, and you can understand why that may not make sense for them or why it seems the point of today's show is don't assume that they're getting the best advice. Is that a bad assumption?
I think I would encourage folks to assume they're not getting good advice.
Okay.
I know that's extremely strong.
Uh-huh.
However, the bar is extraordinarily low. Okay. To call yourself a financial advisor.
Right.
So I think we should talk about a couple different issues.
Okay.
So as you were doing the intro, I was thinking, okay, I want to talk about investments. I want to talk about licensure. I want to talk about insurance and the way that folks should really approach their advisors.
Well, and
so there's layers to this.
You will talk about this, I'm sure, but fiduciary duty.
Yeah.
That's what shocked me is who the advisor's duty is to. So
let's start with investments, because when people say financial advisor, most of the time what they're thinking of is an investment advisor.
Sure.
Typically. And really, I mean, there's a lot that some securities attorneys going to listen to this and go, hey, this is incorrect. But look, I mean, you know, this goes all the way back to the 40 Act. Okay.
Sure.
So really, you got to think about it in two ways in the United States. There are broker dealers and there are RIAs, registered investment advisors, okay? These are companies. So a broker-dealer is a company, so is a registered investment advisor, okay?
Okay, that confused me when I was taking my Series 65. So an RIA, a registered investment advisor, sounds like a person, like a human.
Yes.
But it's not.
It is not.
Okay, who is the human that works for that company?
You guys are going to love this. It's the investment advisor representative. So an IAR works for an RIA. And this is like, you know, I get tripped up on this all the time.
Sure.
You know, the language. But I want to break it down into those two groups to start with, because they have different, they're regulated differently, and they have different things that they can do. Mm-hmm. So most folks, their advisor, and historically this has been the case, if you're a retail investor, most likely you've worked with someone who works for a broker dealer.
Okay.
And the person who works for a broker dealer, they're called a registered representative, typically.
These are your Edward Jones.
This is your Edward Jones. This is your Merrill Lynch, your Goldman Sachs, your, you know, think of any big name household firm.
Okay.
Most likely they're a broker dealer. Now, it's going to get a little bit more confusing. You can have a hybrid broker dealer RIA. So we'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
But a broker dealer is a company that sells securities either from their own account or on behalf of someone else. Okay. So when they're acting as a dealer, they're selling their own securities. When they're acting as a broker, they're selling someone else's.
So in my head, I thought when I go to an investment advisor and I'm buying Apple stock, they just buy it from
the market.
Yeah. The market, you know, And so I just assumed they were buying it from the market from some individual who was selling, but that's not always the case.
That's not always the case.
Okay.
No. And so this goes back to how things were, you know, how transactions happened, you know, almost 100 years ago.
Okay.
Right. You got to think about it this way, you know. And so what would happen would be, in some cases, broker dealers would help to underwrite stock offerings. So you get a group of them together and you'd have a company like, let's say, Apple at the beginning, right?
Okay.
Apple would say, okay, we're going to offer our stock to the public.
We're going
to
go public.
We're going to go public. As it's called. Mm-hmm. And what would happen is banks, the underwriting team, is what it's called, would say, okay, we're going to agree to sell, you know, X number of shares, basically.
Okay.
So they will buy them and then mark them up and sell them to everybody else.
Okay.
So sometimes they keep some back for, you know, their own account, right?
Right.
And so the reason I say this is they, in those situations, they make money either as a commission. So if they were selling someone, you know, security for somebody else, they're making a commission, or they're marking up the price of that security. So they bought it for $10, they're selling it to you for $12.
Okay. Sure.
You know.
Okay.
And so the more liquid the market, the smaller that margin is, you know. So they operate on a commission basis. That's not inherently a bad thing necessarily, because another word for commission is fee, right? So really we all work for fees,
right?
Okay. But what I find is that the average consumer doesn't have awareness of how this stuff works. And these are fairly complicated transactions. So this is the first thing to understand. Most advisors are commission based, which means they're incentivized to sell you something that may not be in your best interest. In a very strict legal sense, they do not have a fiduciary best interest standard.
Okay.
They have what's called a suitability standard.
Okay. So there is not the fiduciary duty
for broker dealers.
Okay.
No, or registered representatives of broker dealers.
Okay.
Now, they've tried to increase the, you know, the requirements there, and it's been laughable, frankly. So here's what happens. They have to make a they have to make a recommendation that is suitable for you. So let's say that you're an investor who has a growth focus. And if you have an Edward Jones advisor, or your clients do, you might see that actual language on the statement.
Right.
So this is a risk tolerance thing. And so they're like, okay, well, you're going for growth. So, you know, here's 10 different funds that could work for that. And so what they have to do is they have to offer, you know, something that is suitable in that. So if you need a, if you want a large cap growth fund, they shouldn't be offering you a bond fund.
Sure.
Okay. So, but as long as they're doing that, they're complying with the law. So here's another way to say it. I'm a fan of tailoring. I like well-cut, you know, suits. So the suitability standard is like going to a suit shop and buying a suit.
Okay.
Working with a fiduciary, the suit not only has to be a suit, it's got to fit and it's got to look good.
Okay.
So what ends up happening is the client ends up getting – they might get a S&P 500 fund, but it doesn't have to be the lowest expense fund.
Or the best one.
Or the best one.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just one.
But it's like, it is one.
Okay.
You know, it's like, it's ice cream technically, but it's not the flavor you wanted. It's not even the size you wanted.
And going back to the suit, there's a small, medium, and large gray suit. And you walk in and you're, you the large pretty much fits you.
It's so all right.
You walk out with a large suit, and so that's suitable.
They sold you a suit. Close right. enough, right?
That's all they had to sell, and so that's what they and so that was suitable for you.
So, I mean, that sounds crazy when we say it in these terms, you know. And this is what most people are used to. This is what they've come to expect. Yeah. So let me parallel to the other side and then tell you where it gets really hairy.
Okay.
So the RIA side, Registered Investment Advisor side, they have a different standard. They have a fiduciary standard, which means that they have to act in the best interest of the client and put the client's interest above their own.
Okay.
Really at all times.
Like attorneys do.
Yes.
Okay.
This makes sense. And frankly, isn't that hard?
Okay. Right. Yeah.
You know, and they have to disclose and manage any conflicts of interest, right? And so they don't sell securities for a commission. They charge, you know, typically a percentage of the assets under management to manage those assets.
Okay.
And there's certain rules about, you know, what those fees can be. But it's a very different situation. And even down to the point of they have to provide the best possible execution of the trades mm-hmm. for their clients. Broker dealers aren't necessarily required to do that. So this is where things like Robinhood became a big issue a couple of years ago. There's something called payment for order flow that a lot of folks don't realize. Mm-hmm. And so what big hedge funds do, Ken Griffin of Citadel is the most notable one, but they all do this. They will pay broker dealer custodians to give them information about trades milliseconds before they happen. So you place an order on Robinhood for 100 shares of XYZ stock, whatever that is. Before the trade is executed, the hedge fund is going to know that you're making that trade. And if they want to, they can trade before you, which means that the price that you get it at is going to be slightly higher than the price they got it at. Or they can buy it and then mark it up just a tiny little fraction and then sell it to you in the 15 seconds that it takes to make that transaction.
Yeah.
Fascinating, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the game. And so it's a very complex system, and mm-hmm. I don't even think most advisors really understand this.
Right. So when a broker dealer representative mm-hmm. Are they limited in what they can sell?
They're massively limited. Now, this has gotten better, I will say.
Okay.
But you've got to think about this, right? I mean, their job as the representative, they're an employee of the broker-dealer, okay? And so
– their loyalty is to their employer.
Yeah. They
just
have,
like we all are.
I mean, there's a technical – if you're an attorney and listen to this, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have a technical fiduciary relationship to the principal, which is your employer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're obligated to act in the best interest of the employer, essentially.
Right.
And so how that plays out in practice is – you know, we talked about the suitability standard. Well, how they get around this is they say, okay, we're going to offer, if we're offering growth funds or large cap US funds, we're going to offer 10 different ones. And there's going to be a couple that are like really bad, just awful funds, like 5.75% upfront, 1.25% every year. You'd be shocked at how many of your clients have these, by the way.
Sure.
And they're going to put a couple of other ones in, and then they're going to put theirs in there. And so this is how they get around their version of the best interest standard.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they're offering the best of what they have access to.
That's
considered best interest.
Yeah. Jeez.
And so it's like, that's like going to Subway and going, hey, I want a hamburger. And they're like, we got meatballs. We got a meatball sub. How's that? Well, there might be hamburger. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's utterly ridiculous. And I honestly think clients are getting screwed all over the place with this.
And don't they sometimes get phone calls mm-hmm. from their boss saying, you need to sell this stock?
Yeah.
Because they just bought it at they just bought a million shares for cheap, and now they want their guys to sell it, and they make money from that. And so when sweet little Miss Jones gets her phone call from her really nice.
So nice.
So nice real estate guy says, Miss Jones, I've been looking at your portfolio, and I think you need this stock.
We got a tip about a great great buy. Remember we had that great that great buy a couple months ago or a couple weeks ago, you know, oh, okay, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, and she trusts him because she thinks he's looking out for her best interest, but they're actually doing what they're being told from their boss.
Which is selling securities to make a commission. It's not inherently bad to make a commission. No. We talked about that. But let's not pretend that there's any sort of best interest situation here.
Okay.
I think the final piece that I'll say on the broker-dealer side is, you know, they had this legislation to try to bring in this best interest situation. Mm-hmm. And so previously, you know, they could have bonus competitions for, you know, you'd get a bonus or go on a trip or whatever for selling certain things. And so their way to make it more transparent was you can do those things still. You just can't have it in a specific security or a specific time frame. So instead of prohibiting, you know, these types of, you get a $50,000 bonus if you sell this stuff by, you know, March 31st,
right.
We just have to take the end date off of it. I mean, it's like...
Oh, that makes it much better.
So here's where it gets really tricky, though. And we've only talked about investments so far, unfortunately. But where it gets really tricky is, you know, you'll have someone like an Edward Jones who they're considered a hybrid. So Edward Jones is both a broker-dealer and a registered investment advisor.
Okay.
Talk about a mess. So, you know, you could have someone who is a certified financial planner. We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
That works for Edward Jones. That is both a registered rep and a investment advisor representative. How is the client supposed to know when they're acting in what capacity? So they're required to say, hey, when they're acting as a registered rep and when they're acting as a investment advisor representative.
Really? Okay.
Do you think the client understands that?
I'm sure it's in the paperwork they sign.
It's got to be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, attorneys know how to... You know, there are some unscrupulous attorneys out there. I don't know if any of your clients, you know this, but I mean, that industry is great at burying stuff in the paperwork.
Sure.
You know, and so we talked a little bit. I said we'll talk about being a certified financial planner. So that is, in at least in my view, and really it is nationwide, that is the most rigorous designation for financial advisors in the country.
Sure.
So there's really two that are respected. One is Certified Financial Planner. One is Chartered Financial Analyst, CFA. So those are like the investment people.
Sure.
They're kind of like the actuaries.
Yeah.
You don't get them out of the back office very much,
right.
Typically.
Yeah.
But financial planners are supposed to really be client-facing. And so it's not the bar exam, but we have pretty in-depth experience in things like cash flow, debt, real estate, investments, taxes, estate planning, insurance, and how those all come together.
So if you think of investment advisor, someone who just – and one of the things we do on the radio show every week is at the beginning of the show, I'll say, Ian, how's the stock market doing? Ian says, I don't know.
I don't spend most of my time paying attention to it because it's not the most meaningful thing.
I do that to shock people because we think of investment advisors, investment people, that's all they do is they're just focused on the stock market, what's good to buy, what's good to sell. And as a financial planner, you named about six other things that weren't investments. Mm-hmm. You're a planner. You plan the whole thing around their life, not just the one thing. And I think that's what surprised me most. I knew there was this thing called a CFP, but I wasn't extremely familiar with what they did or what their standard was. And this has really opened my eyes. And particularly once I got into it myself and saw, oh, there's some stuff going on behind the curtains here that I think most people don't know about.
It's a big challenge, I think. Mm-hmm. The CFP is the most respected financial designation, and CFPs are, you know, governed by their board, the CFP board, and so they are required to act as fiduciaries. Mm-hmm. That's the expectation. Now, the challenge that I have, we talked about one that worked at, say, Edward Jones. I'm beating up Edward Jones because mm-hmm. they're easy to beat up. Here's my dilemma, and here's the challenge that I have. And I just think it's tough to think about. You got to wrestle with this. Yeah. If they're a CFP.
You get offers from them all the time, don't you?
I mean, it's like, but I'm not going to play that game. Sure. You know, they're like, hey, we got a big book of business. Like, who calls their clients a book of business? Like, I mean, what kind of, I mean,
Edward Jones guys.
There's a reason that this industry and the financial industry and the insurance industry have a reputation that is similar to like the used car industry. Because sure. There are similar quality folks that mm-hmm. are very common. But what I want to submit to you is, even if someone is a CFP that works at a company like that, mm-hmm. if they're an employee and they're a registered rep, are they being incentivized in a way that makes it hard for them to live up to that fiduciary duty at all times? Mm-hmm. I think probably so. I don't know how somebody can meet sales quotas and be doing what's in the best interest of their clients.
You know, this is going to get me some hate mail if this goes to non-attorneys. It's okay. I'm a big boy. I can handle it.
It's just, I would rather, and I think, you know, the folks that listen to this, would you rather know the truth or would you rather someone really nice smile at you and lie to you? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's really the issue.
Right.
The other thing that I think is worth pointing out, and I feel comfortable saying this to attorneys, you know, I have an insurance license. I technically have a Series 65. When you have a CFP, you don't have to maintain it sure. anymore. So the insurance license and the Series 65, I'm a good test taker, but the insurance license, I studied for a couple of days and took it. The Series 65 is going to make you mad, but sorry. I studied for 2 days and passed the Series 65. And that was like 6 hour days, you know, while I was working a full-time job with a like 3-month-old kid.
Sure.
And the CFP was, I mean, it was a good 6 weeks of study for sure. me. Yeah. And so like, there's a difference between someone who can call themselves a financial advisor mm-hmm. and an actual financial planner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's like someone who took a legal class in college and someone who's an attorney. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a fairly comparable sure. leap there.
Yeah.
You know, they know about laws, but that doesn't make them an attorney.
Yeah, that doesn't make. I mean, and the point being, the bar to get your Series 65 or 63 or whatever is very, very low.
Shockingly low.
Shockingly low. Yeah. And once you get it, you can charge for financial advice and really not know squat about anything, really.
Yeah, it's a problem. And so the other side of that is the insurance world. Mm-hmm. You know, life insurance, annuities is the big one mm-hmm. that probably a lot of your folks see. You know, that's not a very high bar. And they have a suitability standard as well. Mm-hmm. And arguably a more flexible suitability standard.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, they are starting to regulate themselves a little bit better, which I appreciate. Their yeah. states are starting to implement closer, more interesting to me, best interest requirements. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's not hard to, you know, to fudge the numbers and get stuff through the insurance company. You know, yeah. I'm sure you see that. People okay. have way more money in annuities than they should. And, you know.
Well, and I think what frustrates me is I have an insurance license also, and I know what that bar is. And there are people out there that for whatever reason did not get their Series 65, but they just have an insurance license.
Yeah.
And they're selling annuities that kind of feel like investments, and they're advertising
themselves, you know, as a financial advisor.
Yeah, so and so financial advisor, and the clients who go to them, they're going to walk out with an annuity because that's all they are, a life insurance product, you know, because that's all they can sell. And these people think that they've gone to a financial advisor, planner, whatever, and they're looking at everything and saying, you know, I've looked at everything and this is what you need most. Because that's all they can sell. And it's just frustrating. I try to bring that up to them and they're just like, oh no, you know, it's just.
Of course, you know, everybody's advisor or insurance person who calls themselves an advisor is like the nicest guy ever, mm-hmm. knows their kids' names. And of course they are, sure. you know, we joke about this, but like, of course they're going to be that way.
Absolutely.
That's the bare minimum. But I think folks need to understand how little real advice and planning these types of folks give and the need for more comprehensive planning. And that's why we started to work together, mm-hmm. really, is mm-hmm. because folks aren't getting it and it affects more areas, you know? So let's say you go to a company, let's pick on Edward Jones Investments again. The name of the company is Edward Jones Investments. Mm-hmm. What do you suppose the focus of those, you know, meetings and relationships are going to be? Mm-hmm. They're going to be investments, mm-hmm. right? And so we shouldn't be surprised by that necessarily, but, you know, there's so much more out there. And what happens is the client might have a half-decent investment portfolio, but they're not coordinating with the estate planning attorney or with the tax professional or the insurance person. Right. And so none of those parts work together. And then when you have to do crisis planning, it's a disaster. Mm-hmm. And it costs people way more money than it needs to.
Well, I lost a client this month because he was very heavily invested in annuities with this one person that advertises herself as investments. And I said, oh, we've got to cash those in because, you know, the spousal share and CSRA, you know, he was way over the CSRA with his annuities. And I said, okay, cash in this one, keep this one, but let's cash those in. We'll put it into the Medicaid qualifying annuity and I can get you qualified January 1st. Well, he never called us back after he went to his annuity salesperson, and that's what I'll call her. And he started getting weird on me. His emails changed. He didn't answer my phone calls. And I was like, you know, I called and I said, hey, we're going to miss the January 1 deadline. And he never called me back. I was like, okay, well, I hadn't heard from him. And so we're now past the middle of January. And I called him and he said, oh, yeah, my annuity person and I are fixing this problem. I'm like, you're not fixing the problem unless she sells a Medicaid qualifying annuity. And I don't think she knows what that is. And so I just told him, I said, well, if I could put it in parentheses, when this goes bad on you, I'll be here to pick up the pieces. That's frustrating that she'll probably get that through, even though it's absolutely not suitable. There is no suitability whatsoever, but she'll probably get that through. And God forbid if it's irrevocable, if she read that term on it thinking, hey, if this is irrevocable, he can't cash it in. I know I'm going to get my commission. Well, when he doesn't get on Medicaid, it's going to be a problem.
And I know the person that you're referring to. Mm-hmm. And I don't hope that it becomes a problem for the client, but that kind of person, mm-hmm. it needs to be a problem for them before long.
Oh, I will make it a problem. Yeah, if I mean, he gets denied after she does all this, I will make it her problem.
And this kind of stuff is so common. You know, it really is frustrating. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think the other part that I want to talk about here, we've talked about how the industry is designed a little bit. It's not designed to really benefit the client in a lot of ways. The industry is mainly designed to sell investment products that benefits investment companies. You know, mm-hmm. if you have a Fidelity advisor, guess what your portfolio is going to be full of?
Fidelity investments.
Fidelity funds. Sure. You know, mm-hmm. great. But I think I really liked what you brought up earlier, Todd, because it's true that most of the time that I spend with my clients is not working on investments. Because there are really like three kind of levels, if you will. We should do a whole episode on this, frankly. Okay. But like most people, most of their advisors have them in really high fee, high expense mutual funds or ETFs that are actively managed. Most people would be better off with basic index funds. That's like the first switch, okay? Save, you know, 1-2% a year. That adds up over time.
Just in case you don't know, an index fund follows an index. Mm-hmm. It's not actively managed. They've set it up to match the Dow Jones 500 or the Russell, whatever. You know, it's set up to follow that index. Mm-hmm. You can have technology indexes. You can have all kinds of different indexes, but it's not actively managed, which cuts down on the fees tremendously.
Yeah. The idea is in the long run, there's really no data that suggests that picking stocks is effective.
Okay.
The best analysts. So think about this. The best analysts in the world. These people have essentially unlimited money to do this. Mm-hmm. They're extraordinarily brilliant. They have all the technology. They have all the money. Best case scenario, it's 50-50 over the long run. So active management, we've got to throw that out. That's not a long-term suitable strategy.
Sure.
Okay. So the next best thing, people would be better off with basic index funds doing it themselves.
Okay.
The problem is behavior is a huge issue.
Yep.
And really, there's something better than that. We have data about this from about 35. Well, we have live data from about 35 years, but we have data from about 60 years, Nobel Prize winning data, a couple of PhD, really smart nerds decided to look at just call it what it is, you know, decided to look at the financial markets scientifically and said, hey, can we, you know, if active management trying to pick stocks doesn't work, can we find something that does? A data-based, what are factors that drive excess returns? They accidentally created indexing when they did this. So like, okay, let's track the average of the market, right?
Yeah.
Most people, they'd be better off with indexing than active management. But if you really want something optimal, you can tilt towards certain things and mm-hmm. do even better.
Well, it's the power of groups.
Yeah.
You know, with an index, you've got hundreds or thousands of companies that in general are going to flow the same way, as opposed to picking one that the CEO embezzled $5 million and, you know, they're gone.
Yeah. The risk return is just, it's not there.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And so what most folks end up getting is a bunch of actively managed mutual funds, because that's what they're able to sell. And so that's how they make fees. Well, they spend most of their time talking about those investments, but really that's not moving the needle for people that much. You know, it would be better off to do it yourself and have a financial planner that's looking at the other pieces, taxes being the big one that we should talk about. You know,
right.
I mean, taxes and tax planning that's most of what I do. And it's where, I mean, we literally find millions of dollars in tax savings for people. I mean, it's shocking how much money we can save.
I think you just explained why you do it. You see, that's a really big bang for the buck to say, hey, we make this change and this change, and I've just saved you $100,000.
Yeah.
It's kind of like making $100,000, which is difficult as a stock trader. But if you save $100,000, hey, that's $100,000 more dollars going to your grandkids.
It's a huge, huge impact. Mm-hmm. And really what ends up happening is, you know, when we coordinate all of those pieces of someone's financial puzzle, not just investments, people just have a better experience of life, I think, mm-hmm. because not everyone needs to have a really complex understanding of every single financial piece that they have. Mm-hmm. But if they have someone that they can talk to that is managing other professionals, that's what we do for our clients, manage sure. those other professionals, mm-hmm. then their time is freed up and they can focus on what's most important. Because yeah. I think what we find a lot is people that, you know, do invest really well, do save really well, work hard, you know, get to retirement age and maybe they've got a couple million bucks saved up, but their habits, their behaviors are not to spend. And not enjoying their time and over saving yeah. is a huge disaster. But when we organize those things in the right way, like, you feel freedom to be able to spend and use your time wisely.
So
you know?
Just to be clear, you just heard a financial planner say over saving can be disastrous.
Yeah.
Which is beyond me. So, okay. So let's kind of bring this into a close. So number one, if you're listening to this and you're thinking personally, I wonder if my investment person is doing the right thing for me, can they call you and yeah, talk?
Sure. I mean, call the office. Yeah. We can do Zoom calls, you know.
Yeah. Call the office and talk, and we would love to talk to you. Ian would love to discuss. He's not going to try to get you away from them, but he can look at your stuff and say, here's the problem I'm seeing. Okay.
I can show you your portfolio in a way you've never seen and yeah. simplify it for you.
Okay. So what if someone as an attorney is meeting with someone that either they see something glaringly wrong or the person is not happy with their investment person? How do you advise someone to leave their investment person and go with someone else?
So I think you know, we should do a episode for our podcast on this too, by the way. I think one of the biggest misnomers is that you have to talk to the other advisor first. Because I think what most people are afraid of when they make a change is having that conversation with the advisor. And you don't actually have to do that. I mean, really what happens is a new account is set up at a new custodian, and 9 times out of 10, the money's transferred automatically. And you don't have to talk to them. And we have a letter that we can, you know, update for you that goes, look, we appreciate all the work you've done up to this point. We're moving in a different direction. Please don't contact us. You know, respect our decision. Thanks for the work that you've done.
I think that's what keeps people there is they don't want to have that conversation with the guy that they see at the kids' baseball field every Saturday.
And boy, that really nice guy, when you move a couple million bucks from him.
Let's see how nice he is.
Yeah, the facade shatters quickly.
Sure.
You know.
So they don't have to talk to him.
They don't have to talk to him. No, and I think that's – and you know, respectfully, you don't owe them that.
Sure.
You have a business relationship with them. Mm-hmm. You have paid them fees for the to not have to have that conversation.
Sure. Call Walmart and say, hey, I'm
shopping to Target now.
I'm going to Target. Do you mind?
You know, it's just, it shouldn't be that kind of thing, right? And I understand. I mean, I have deep relationships with my clients.
Sure.
You know, but if they feel like I'm not giving them the service that they're paying for, I don't want to work with them. Mm-hmm. That should not be the case, you know? So that's one thing. I mean, you know, if you have questions about a portfolio, I mean, we can't do 100 of these a week, right? But I mean, we have technology that can do very quick portfolio analysis and tax analysis for people.
Yeah.
I mean, especially if they're doing estate planning, you know, we can do a tax report for them that shows how much they're going to pay in taxes if they're trying to transfer money. I think that's a value add for clients.
Yeah.
So happy to discuss that.
Cool. Yeah. So yeah, just call the office 479-601-4119. That's for if you have a investment question or concern personally or for a client, we can definitely deal with that. And if you would like to be if you would like for me to be your coach, I would love that. Okay. Call the office 479-601-4119. Tell Fabiana that you want to talk with Tricia. Tricia will give you some preliminary information, and then she will set you up a phone call with me. Let's talk. Let me just see what's going on in your practice, see what you want, and see if my services can help you with that. But I've been doing this almost 26 years. I'm a certified elder law attorney. I was on the board of directors for the certifying board, and I was its president for 2 years. And so I love what I do. I think it's the best job in the world. You get hugs, you get checks, you get happy people that come in sad. It's just absolutely the best job in the world. And I would love to be your coach. And if you'll give me a year, I can make you a pretty good elder law attorney. Okay. So call our office. Let's talk about it. And particularly if you have investment questions personally or for clients, please give us a call and we will be glad to work with you. Anything else, Ian?
There's so much more we could talk about. We're going to have to do another episode because I'm thinking of all this stuff. I know I'm long-winded, but
that's
you know,
fine. Yeah.
We need to talk about the report that we put together for folks. And, you know, maybe for your, we do something special for your coaching clients.
Okay. We will work on that. But yeah, give us a call and we would love to work with you. Thank y'all. Please subscribe and we will see you next time.